It's The Record on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Hello, I'm Kim Malcolm, in for Bill Radke today. Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump is expected to make appearances today at a rally in Everett and a fundraiser at an undisclosed location in the Seattle area. Pollsters give Trump little chance of winning Washington State in November. The state has not chosen a Republican for president in more than 30 years. So why would the Trump campaign head to the traditionally liberal Seattle area? KUOW's investigative reporter John Ryan has the story.
By coming to Western Washington, Trump is heading into largely enemy territory. The latest polls give Democrat Hillary Clinton a double-digit lead over Trump statewide. In King County, the Elway poll gives Clinton more than a 40-point lead. Even much of the Republican establishment here has turned its back on its top candidate. The Republican nominee for governor, Bill Bryant, says he'll be volunteering at a homeless shelter during Trump's rally. The Trump campaign canceled this week's trip to Portland, where the politics also lean to the left. None of that is stopping Trump from rallying in Washington.
I think it's incredible. We have a presidential candidate who's coming to Washington State three times to speak directly to the people in free public rallies. That's something you just don't see from the Democrat candidate.
Doug Erickson is a state senator from Ferndale and a Trump campaign spokesperson.
He believes that if he's going to be in Washington, he wants to meet with the people, not just go to the rich suburbs, get a check, and cut out of town.
So far, Washington has not been fertile fundraising territory for Trump either. Hillary Clinton has raised eight times more money in Washington State than Donald Trump has, nearly $6 million for her, just $700,000 for him. Even a disparity that big doesn't mean it's a bad idea for a candidate to come calling here. Margaret O'Meara studies presidential campaigns. She's a historian at the University of Washington.
In a place like Seattle, a candidate of either party can do one event with a small group of very deep-pocketed donors and raise a heck of a lot of money in a very little time. And that certainly seems to be what Trump is doing in his visit. And he's just tagging on a rally as a bonus to that.
Candidates for both parties visited Washington before the state primaries. But O'Meara says it's rare for a party's nominee to visit our state, except to use the Seattle area's concentrated wealth as a sort of ATM. Presidential rallies this close to the November election are almost unheard of here. Trump's advisors have reportedly urged him to be more strategic with his time and knock off the rallies in states that are bright blue or deeply red. O'Meara says Trump doesn't sacrifice all that much when he visits non-battleground states like Washington. That's because of his unusual ability to draw media coverage with incendiary rhetoric.
He's going to places that aren't swing states, but he also is doing rallies not just for the people who are there in the airplane hangar or the auditorium that he's talking to. They are media events, because wherever Trump goes, it becomes national news, and he can reach voters across the country.
The big rally in Everett is expected to draw big press coverage and protests. The secretive fundraiser, not so much. The campaign wouldn't even say which rich suburb it's being held in. The rally is free. The fundraiser costs at least $2,700 to get in. For just $10,000, you can get a photo of yourself with Donald Trump. Reporting in Seattle, I'm John Ryan, KUOW News.
That's a look at why Donald Trump is here. Now, what can his thousands of supporters expect to hear tonight? And why will they hear it in Snohomish County? Knute Berger is with Crosscut. He told me why Everett is a smart choice for Trump.
Well, it's a great place to hold a rally in Western Washington for him. Well, it's accessible. It's right on the I-5 corridor. He's got a big arena there. But I think that the main reason is that Everett and Snohomish County, to some degree, mimic some of the things that have been going on in the industrial Midwest that speak to the kinds of issues that Trump is trying to capitalize on in his campaign.
Democratic Snohomish County Council member Brian Sullivan described Everett to Crosscut this week as a kind of wind tunnel where economic growth is happening all around the city, just not in it. What did he mean by that?
Snohomish County has a very high percentage of employees who are in manufacturing. Most of those manufacturing plants and jobs are connected to Boeing in one way or aerospace in one way or the other. And most of them are outside of the city of Everett. The city of Everett, in some ways, is kind of troubled. And I there was an article in the LA Times this year about the drug problem, big OxyContin problem there.
Opioid epidemic.
Yeah. Home ownership is down there. There are just a number of indicators. And I think there's a certain been a certain kind of confidence in the fact that Boeing has been such a mainstay, both of the city and the county's economic. But, you know, Boeing also brings with it all kinds of question marks in terms of, you know, how long are these manufacturing jobs going to stay here? They're shrinking already. Are they going to go overseas? You know, all those questions, I think, come up. Well,
Trump has raised them. He is suggesting that the jobs are going to China.
Well, and that's going to resonate with some people. Boeing has outsourced some of the parts for some of its planes. They're doing some of the assembly work or going to be doing some assembly work in China. So those things will resonate. On the flip side, you know, Everett and the whole Puget Sound region have benefited from trade with Asia. So there's this kind of, you know, constant balance. But I think a lot of the insecurity of the shrinking manufacturing base. And also Everett is not enjoying the kind of urban revival that the tech industry has brought, you know, to Seattle, to Bellevue and the East Side. I was looking at the job makeup of the workforce there. And there are a lot of young people in Snohomish County, and they're kids because people are moving there. They can afford to get a suburban house and have a family. But the workforce is sort of missing that younger demographic, people in their 20s who are getting into tech and that kind of thing. And so I think there's a, you know, concern that that the city itself is not kind of renewing itself the way other cities on Puget Sound are.
You mentioned Boeing and manufacturing. What kinds of issues do you think he's going to bring up beyond that?
Well, I certainly would be surprised if he doesn't bring up trade and the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the controversy over that. I'd be really surprised if he didn't bring that up. He has brought up Boeing before, and that, you know, I think that'll be a big issue that he'll talk about. And, you know, Trump always speaks to kind of a white middle-class insecurity about the future, about your place in America, about political correctness. I think those will be very much a part of it, too.
What kind of impact do you think state Republicans are hoping Trump will have on local races and other races that are going to be up and down the ballot this fall?
Well, there's an interesting tension there because some people think that Republicans think that running away from Trump, not endorsing Trump, is a good strategy for running for office, including Bill Bryant, who's the Republican candidate for governor. On the other hand, the state party believes that places like Snohomish, where there are a fairly substantial number of swing voters, can be turned red politically in the governor's race because they're hoping Trump will turn out some non-traditional Republican voters for them. And if they can win in a place like Snohomish County, they think they can win statewide.
When Donald Trump travels to places like West Virginia, he likes to talk about coal and bringing back coal jobs. Is there a parallel that you think he might make here in Washington?
Well, in Snohomish County, there still is a resource economy. So it wouldn't surprise me if he talks about mining and timber and those kinds of things. The real driver, though, is manufacturing jobs. And that's what Snohomish County is at risk of losing. That's what Snohomish County wants more of. And so if he can play to those tensions, I think that's the coal of Snohomish County.
You found an interesting historical connection that Donald Trump has with Snohomish County. Tell us about that.
One thing that was pointed out, Peter Jackson, who wrote a great article about Everett and Trump, pointed out that John D. Rockefeller was one of the big investors early on in Everett. And this sort of legitimized investment. It was sort of, I mean, he was the billionaire of the 19th century. He was the guy that everybody wanted to emulate. He not only invested in the industrial complex in Everett, he owned the railroad that went up to the Monte Cristo mines.
And where was that located?
The Monte Cristo mines, basically, if you just go due east into the Cascades from Everett, there's Big mining was a big mining boom town in the 1890s into the early 20th century up there called Monte Cristo. And they discovered gold and silver and lead and other things up there. And so it was a boom town in the 1890s. And Rockefeller owned a bunch of those mines. So he did the classic Rockefeller thing where you own the town, you own the railroad.
Right.
But one of the guys attracted to Monte Cristo in the 1890s who built a hotel there was Frederick Drumpf.
With a D.
Yes. Donald Trump's grandfather. And so I just think that he has actually a direct connection in that both in Everett and in the old resource economy of Snohomish County. His grandfather was there. He was actually elected Justice of the Peace of Monte Cristo in 1896. So he actually was elected to public office in Snohomish County way back when.
So Donald Trump, he has deep roots in Snohomish County.
Deeper, I think, than any of us ever thought.
That was Knut Berger. He's a writer for Crosscut. Trump's rally in Everett starts tonight at 7 at the Xfinity Arena. People are already in line to see him speak. KUOW is covering the event later this afternoon and tomorrow morning. This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Kim Malcolm.
Merhaban.
Ni hao.
Hello.
Bonjour.
Namaste. Yesu.
Hey.
Ciao.
Hello.
During this election year, resettling refugees has become a political flashpoint. The rhetoric has raised questions about newcomers in the U.S. How many should we bring here? And what happens after they arrive? Today, we kick off a series that introduces some refugees at the heart of this debate. KUOW's Liz Jones followed three refugees through their first year in the Seattle area. For many, this year can feel like a race against the clock to set up a new life. We start with Tutu's story. He's a young man from Burma, grappling with English and big choices for his future.
Day one in America at the airport baggage claim.
Good.
Tutu lugs a bag off the carousel. He's 20 years old, playful, smiling, with long bangs and torn jeans. He looks pretty American, but he barely speaks English. Later, he'll tell me that really scared him. How would he get by if he can't communicate? It's a fear he pushes aside. He's not supposed to be a kid anymore. Tutu's cousin, Sheltar, is here to greet him after many years apart. They cry, but they don't hug. That's the culture in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. Tutu came here alone as a refugee. He'll live with Sheltar, who made this same journey 7 years ago, from a refugee camp in Thailand to Seattle. In the past decade, Burmese refugees have topped the list of new arrivals to the U.S. It's a relatively new community finding its way here. It's around sunset when we arrive at Sheltar's two-bedroom apartment in Kent. Her sister's family also lives here. Tutu brings a total to 9. He'll sleep on a twin bed in the living room. Tutu's his full name, by the way. In Myanmar, you don't use last names. I'm curious to see what Tutu's brought from home. He fishes a picture frame out of his backpack.
Aw, they had a good friend.
It's his girlfriend at the refugee camp.
What does it say there?
Forever love.
Forever love.
He pulls a Bible from his bag, and then another.
How many Bibles did you bring?
Yeah.
We count at least 4, in his native Karen and in English, a language he's eager to practice.
Hello, friend.
Hello, friend.
Hello, friend. How are you?
That sounds good.
Yeah. And I know you are very tired now. So
that's Cordelia Revels, Tutu's resettlement case manager with Jewish Family Service. An interpreter is also along to help. The agency will help Tutu with his initial resettlement for up to 3 months. They go over small items.
So we have a toothbrush and toothpaste.
And then larger goals.
We'll start working on everything else, like signing up for English classes and looking for a job. and learning how to ride the bus. So we will be with you a lot in the next few days.
Tutu nods along to the interpreter. More than anything, he wants to learn English, maybe even be an interpreter himself someday. But he'll also need a job. Decisions like this matter as he sets the mold for his life here.
$20.
For now, Revels leaves Tutu a $20 bill, just for pocket money. He'll spend it in a few hours on a phone card to call his dad back in Thailand. Up until now, Tutu spent most his life in a refugee camp. His family is Karen, an ethnic minority in Myanmar. And for decades, military forces have attacked and burned ethnic villages. More than a million people have been displaced, including Tutu's family. Months after we meet, we briefly talk about this with an interpreter. At first, Tutu makes light of it.
While we moved to camp, I carry one chicken, and that's what I remember.
It's a child's memory. He was only about five.
So it was just sudden. Sudden you had to pick up and leave?
Yeah, suddenly it was a attack. They tried to kill all the Karen people. So then my grandmother had to carry me out.
His grandmother later told him many people died on the way to Thailand. I ask about his other family.
No brother or sister?
No.
They passed away. Yeah.
What happened to your brother and sister?
He says his siblings got sick and died young. His mother left after he was born. In Thailand, Tutu settled into a routine life with his father and grandmother, but it was like living in a cage. And as he got older, his dad pushed him to leave and look for opportunity. Tutu wanted to stay, but he followed his dad's wishes. Now in America, Tutu is starting over again. His youth is on his side. Kids typically adapt easier than adults, but he's right on that line, somewhere in between. Remember, he's just 20. Tutu's first weeks here go by in a blur, full of so many first times. He figures out the bus system and how drivers don't like it if you hand them folded dollar bills
open.
Or try to get on too soon. And that you fall over when the bus lurches forward.
Get some fish today.
His cousin Sheltar teaches him grocery store 101. By
the arm. Fresh today, like yeah. The date today. So.
The expiration date, yeah.
Okay, Joy. We do, right?
Yeah.
He asks this one is like expensive.
Well, then
Does a lot of this stuff look strange to you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Over there, like we eat like fresh, we didn't put in the freezer like that.
Tutu buys some ice cream. But at home, there's a whole pig stuffed in the freezer. So the ice cream goes in the fridge. He meets several times with an employment specialist named Summer.
Let's start by asking him about his education. Did he finish school in his country?
Tutu only got through 11th grade. That'll hurt his job prospects. A key goal of the U.S. resettlement program is for refugees to be self-sufficient and to get jobs in the first few months. Summer pushes Tutu to get a part-time job as soon as possible.
Because he needs to pay bills, the cash he receives from DSHS will not be enough to cover everything. And he said only education, only school now.
They go around on this a few times.
I'll just have to think about it, more about it.
I don't want to push him. But
for Tutu's first 8 months here, he gets government aid of $320 a month, as long as he's looking for work. It's not much, but it buys him a little cushion of time, and he wants to use it to learn English. It's his cousin Sheltar's advice. She and her husband never had this cushion. They had to pay the rent. And she says it made her feel bad, that maybe her coworkers didn't like her because she couldn't understand English. Tutu can set a different course. It's up to him now to take charge.
I need him to sign in here.
Okay.
We'll pick up on Tutu's story tomorrow. That was KUOW's race and culture reporter, Liz Jones. Our series is called Upon Arrival. You can find photos and more stories online at KUOW.org. One of the places refugees are coming from is the Middle East. The ongoing conflict in Syria is not just taking lives, it's shaving years off people's life expectancy, too. That's according to a study led by University of Washington professor Ali Mokhtad. The study, published this month, says life expectancy for men in Syria decreased by 6 years between 2011 and 2013, while women lost 5 years in that short time. And Mokhtad says that's an important indicator of how badly the country is suffering.
It's like a pulse, like taking somebody's pulse. It tells you what's happening in a country. It's one of the indicators. If it drops, there is something going on. If it's going up, there's progress in terms of health. When you look at what happened in Syria and look at going back, there has been a tremendous increase in life expectancy in Syria from 1990 to 2011 before the uprising. And that sudden drop is a warning that there is an emergency going on, which we all know about. But coupled with the past and what the future is, that's an indication of we have a serious problem that we have to deal with in Syria.
What was your reaction when you saw these numbers and found that the war has decreased life expectancy in Syria so quickly?
First, it comes as a big shock for you, knowing that, you know, in Syria, infant mortality and maternal mortality is increasing at a time where it's decreasing everywhere, even in sub-Saharan Africa. Also, keep in mind that we stopped at 2013 and the war is still going on and we are in 2016. So what I'm reporting is an underestimate of what's really happening right now in Syria. And it makes you put things into perspective that this is a disaster unfolding in front of all of us and there is nothing been done about it.
The immediate impacts of this conflict are hard to miss. People are dying. They are being injured in this conflict now. But in the long term, why is the conflict causing this decrease in life expectancy?
So there are two things. One is you're saying that people are dying from the fighting and the war. But there are also many people who are dying silently from malnutrition or lack of services. So unfortunately, in media, we get the attention. We say so many people died from an explosion, from a shelling. But there are many people who are dying quietly, unfortunately, because of lack of services. And then if you keep that in mind, that there has been a destruction of all the infrastructure of public health, and you have a generation right now that hasn't received immunization or the services that they deserve, and they're weak, and they're more prone to diseases. And that will continue in the future unless it's really targeted and a major intervention happens.
What parts of the infrastructure are you really concerned about that are breaking down here?
So for you, all the hospitals, you know, there are reports in Syria that about 50% of the hospitals are not functioning, or even if they are functioning, they're not functioning the way they should. So one is the hospital, which is the basic, the medical services, but also you look at the infrastructure for roads. I mean, if you want to deliver supplies, you need safety for the drivers. You need the electricity because immunization, you know, operating room, they need electricity. All of these have to be rebuilt in order for you to improve health.
Clean water?
Clean water is a major thing. You know, there is a major destruction of clean water. Fluoride has not been used. Chlorine has not been used. And there are so many outbreaks and infection because people are taking surface water. I mean, people have to drink and have to wash their clothes and wash their food. And there is no clean water. And, you know, you ask them to boil it, but sometimes they cannot even find wood or gas to boil their water. So this will take a long time to rebuild. And when a government, you know, all the resources of the Syrian government have been depleted in the war. And then when they start rebuilding, government tend, you know, like in a business model, they will start building what makes them money. Cell phones, for example, will be rebuilt first because there is a monthly income from cell phone. You pay to use your cell phone. But when you talk about water, what you're asking, that's a long-term return on your investment. And that will take a backseat, unfortunately.
You've been studying the health impacts of the conflict in Syria for some time. What are you hearing from people there now and what they're going through?
Right now, most people are trying to stay alive and they're struggling to find food. Basically, when it comes to medication, for some of them, it's a luxury and they're cutting down on their meds and they're not able to get that. But what you hear from is people are suffering from diseases that we felt in the Middle East that we have eradicated those and controlled them for a long time. So I just came from Lebanon, where we have refugees in Lebanon, and some of my friends are telling me they're seeing stuff that they haven't learned in medical school, this young generation. And it's the older guys, old doctors who have been dealing with it in the past that are coming back now, which is sad. One, there are also a lot of issues that are happening that we don't talk about much in the Arab world. Mental health. You have people who are suffering quietly from mental health. And even a refugee coming to Lebanon, you know, hearing a tire blow or, you know, any explosion, even if it is a firecracker, it brings a lot of memories, and they are dealing quietly with mental health, depression, and anxiety. At a time when all the agencies who are in Syria, all what they are trying to do is to make sure you get a vaccine or food, or you are rehydrated, or if you are wasted, you get the food that you need. But nobody is in his or her mind that we also need to bring medication for mental health and start screening people. So there is a lot of problems that are going on that people are dealing with quietly without any support.
You know, many of us may pick up the newspaper or check the latest news headlines, and it can seem very far away. Why should Americans care about the breakdown of a public health system in a country that's over 6,000 miles away?
It's a very good question. You know, it's a small world. I'll give you an example. Ebola, for example. Countries were not prepared for Ebola, and look what happened. And we had Ebola cases in the U.S. Zika virus. We have people who have Zika coming here. We live in a time and age where I could be on a plane in Lebanon or in Syria, and I could be here 10, 15 hours later in Europe or in the U.S. So as a U.S. citizen, you know, as a father or as a daughter here, my advantage is to catch a disease in a country and deal with it before it gets to my own country here. So it's a problem. It's our problem. It's in our backyard, whether we like it or not. It could be here in 15 hours if we don't deal with it back and catch it early on. It's a bigger problem than what we feel.
What can we do about it?
There is a lot that we can do. I mean, this country is wonderful. We have a history of being able to rebuild and help. We have a lot of agencies here who have been very active and have a lot of experience, you know, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, USAID. We could bring not only our power, financial power in rebuilding, but our know-how. There is a dire need for rebuilding health systems in the Middle East, in Syria, Yemen, Libya, and we need to have a roadmap for fixing all these problems, health problems. And what we are concerned about here, and that's why we publish and we scream, quite honestly, is hopefully after the war ends, and hopefully soon, and the media is out of there, we don't forget the people of Syria and the region. And we still are willing to help them. And we should, to our own benefit.
Ali Mokhtad is the director of Middle Eastern Initiatives and a professor of global health at the University of Washington. He led a study that found life expectancy dropped in Syria by at least 5 years between 2011 and 2013. He says life expectancy has likely dropped even more over the past 3 years. In 2014, the Auburn Police Department got international attention after a Native woman went missing there, actress Misty Upham. She'd acted in the HBO series Big Love, the movies Django Unchained, and August, Osage County. But Upham also had a history of mental illness. In October of 2014, Upham was living in Auburn with her parents, and that's when she went missing. An investigation by the Guardian newspaper last year found the Auburn police did very little to help find her. Kristen Millaris-Young wrote that piece for the Guardian. Young told KUOW's Jeannie Yandel about the Auburn police's last interaction with Upham. A deli worker called and said Upham had no shoes on and was hiding in the bushes outside the store. When the police arrived on the scene, they dragged Upham from the bushes, handcuffed her, and put her in the squad car.
And one of the officers said to her, well, if you're so famous, you know, if you're an actress, why don't you call up your friend Robin Williams and have him come save you? And when the Auburn PD later characterized their interactions with Misty Upham, they said that they had acted with professionalism and compassion. And I think that this officer's own report from that evening, he admitted that he mocked her and her kind of lack of agency. I mean, once you're in the back of that patrol car, they're the only ones who can really let you out.
During this final interaction with the Auburn police, where she was handcuffed and put in the back of the car, she had a lot going on in her personal life. What was happening in Misty Upham's personal life at that time?
Well, she had moved to Washington State to kind of gather resources and to help her father in his recovery from a stroke. And they were living in her sister's small apartment. And she had always been one of the main financial supports for her parents. But I think that the hardest thing for her was that she had just suffered a miscarriage. And she had very much wanted to keep this son. And she was not able to. At the same time that she suffered that trauma, because she had moved from California to Washington and was accessing health care through the Indian Health Service, she needed to go through a process to reapply for her prescriptions for benzodiazepines, which she used to control her anxiety, which was rampant. And she also was suffering from depression, and she had PTSD as a result of a series of rapes in her childhood. And so she had been in Washington for months, and, you know, one by one, these prescriptions were running out. And so she, according to her friends and family, turned to alcohol to try to dull this constant anxiety and panic that she suffered. And I think about that, being in a very small apartment, suffering from panic attacks, being so far away from the culture that supported her acting. And I think the pressure of maintaining that became too much to bear.
Misty Upham went missing about 6 weeks later. She went missing on October 5th, 2014. She left the apartment very upset. What did the police do next at that point?
Her father went after her, but was not, you know, immediately behind her, but close enough. When he got down to the bottom of the stairs, the first thing the police said was like, hey, and they made him go back upstairs to search the apartment. They did not believe him that she was not there. And those were critical minutes. We know from the King County Medical Examiner's estimate that she died around 9 p.m. that same day in woods that are a very short walking distance. In fact, she and her father used to walk their dog by those woods all the time. But what we don't know is, where did she go immediately? When those police officers were with her father, was she already in the woods? We don't know that.
In the process of reporting this story for The Guardian, what did you learn about what the Auburn police did to try and find Misty Upham once she went missing?
What I found is that they did not invest the necessary time and resources to find or search for Misty. While they did conduct an investigation over a period of months, it was intermittent. And I know that had it been one of their daughters who had gone missing, they would have created a radically different response.
How do you know that?
If you look at other investigations that they were conducting, they used their Facebook page as a way to gather tips. They put information out there. They gave out updates. You know, they didn't even go to Facebook to distribute a photo of Misty. It would have taken them 5 seconds to put a photo of Misty online, but they never did. In fact, the only time that they began sharing on social media or via press release what was happening with Misty was when their constant pressure from the public and the media made it more efficient for them to do so rather than responding individually to the media requests. And when they first received those calls and emails, they said, no, we have no plans to even create a press release to confirm that Misty is missing and ask for tips leading to her appearance. That's minimum. That's a bare minimum to announce that a member of a community is missing and ask for tips.
Clearly this bothers you. Working on this story has gotten under your skin a little bit, it seems like, from what I'm observing. What is it that got under your skin about this?
Well, I think as a human being, I believe that each human life has value. And Misty Uppin was treated like her life had no value. And that fundamental injustice rankled. It still rankles. But also, I think about this person who, against all odds, had accomplished tremendous things. She was a preeminent Native actress, and she was young still. And so that all of that grit and determination would be dismissed because she was a brown woman who occasionally acted erratically in front of the police. And knowing how much I and everyone rely on the police to keep us safe, it made me feel tremendously unsafe to know that care is so subjective. And on a more personal level, you know, she and I were pregnant at around the same time. And, you know, I was able to birth my son. And I think about the joy that he's brought me and what that kind of joy might have done for Misty during this difficult time in her life, whether it would have made the difference. And in the end, it's a combination of factors. We don't know what would have made the difference for her, but that she was not given that chance. She deserved better.
Kristen Miarez-Young is a Seattle-based reporter and writer. Her story about the 2014 disappearance and death of Native American actor Misty Uppin was published in the Guardian newspaper. We're tweeting out a link to that story now. The government in Canada has begun an inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women. More than 1,000 Indigenous women have gone missing or been murdered in Canada since the 1980s. KUOW's Bill Radke talked to CBC reporter Connie Walker on the record yesterday. You can hear that interview on our website, KUOW.org. Thanks for joining us here on KUOW's The Record. I'm Kim Malcolm. Washington State students have taken a test, and the results don't look great. The Smarter Balanced Assessment is in its second year as the state's main K-12 standardized test. The state is boasting that test scores are up, but in math, fewer than half of Washington's students pass the test. And in English language arts, it doesn't look great either. KUOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld recently sat down with Bill Radke to explain what's going on with the state's test scores.
Overall, the average proficiency is in the F or F minus zone, which might make you think that Washington students aren't learning anything. But, you know, the saying, there are three kinds of lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Statistics. Okay, so let's get at that, because some people, of course, are doing better than average and some are doing worse. So when you break down the scores more intelligently, what do they tell us?
Well, math scores were the lowest in most grades. Fewer than half of the students who tested were proficient. Black, Latino, and Native American kids did the worst, which is what we tend to see. Only about a third of Black third graders showed proficiency on the English language arts test, and white and Asian students did at least twice as well on average. We've seen that huge gap for years between Black and Latino students and white and Asian students.
Why is it that so many students are not passing these tests?
There are a lot of factors at work. One of them is that the tests are a lot harder than the previous tests the state used until last year. So scores across the board now average 5 to 10 points lower than they did on the old tests. The state had warned about that when the new test came out. And when it comes to the gap between racial groups, race is a proxy for income in this country. And of course, we see huge disparities between different races when it comes to family wealth and income level. And wealth is the major predictor of how ready a child is for school when they arrive in kindergarten and how much academic support they'll have outside of school throughout their school career. So by that, what I mean is that if your parents work nights or they don't speak English, it's hard to get help on your homework. And kids who grow up in poverty often have physiological disadvantages as well, because scientists say that if a child grows up with traumatic experiences like, say, violence down the street that they're afraid of or food insecurity, it kind of rewires their brain for this stress response rather than abstract concepts like math and focusing in school and on things like standardized tests.
That makes a lot of sense, Anne, but what if I just want to blame somebody? Where do I point the finger?
Well, the most typically blamed folks are either the schools or legislators, that funding is way too low for schools. But the reality is that the levels of child poverty in this country are astronomically high. And school is only a part of a child's education system. The entire world that they live in contributes. Kids need support after school, on the weekend, just like you and I probably had. They need to have safe and healthy environments with plenty of guidance from adults. And that's really hard in high poverty environments. And schools can definitely help with that with abundant funding, and teachers can get more training to help meet students' needs and teach traumatized kiddos. But we probably won't see major changes in academic success without a sea change when it comes to the way this huge proportion of kids in the state and around the country are supported inside and outside of school.
Those are some major factors. What else might be going on here?
Well, there are other factors, like a lot of students or their families are opting out of testing, especially in high school. That skews the testing data. And another issue is that this new test is done on a computer, so teachers say it's hard for little kids who don't have computers at home to do their best on hardware that's unfamiliar to them. Their keyboarding skills might not be that great. And finally, the Smarter Balance test has a lot of critics who say it's poorly designed and too hard for students to parse, even good students. And if that's true, then some kids might know a lot more than they're being given credit for. But regardless of whether the test is truly broken, the number of confounding factors that I've just discussed when it comes to standardized testing means that these results are really not reliable gauges of school or teacher quality.
I've always wanted to know this, Anne. I'm a parent. I'm looking for the best place for my child. I see a certain school's test scores are not good. I might think, okay, got it, not a good school. Is that fair?
No, I think the best thing to do is to talk to other families whose children attend the school, to visit the school, to see it for yourself, and to see if it feels like a good fit. There might be a child in your child's class who is an immigrant family, and they might do poorly on a test. That doesn't mean that your child won't be getting a great education.
KUOW education reporter Anne Dornfeld. She spoke with my colleague Bill Radke. Has your child failed one of these tests? We'd love to hear your story. Email us at record@kuow.org. You almost done with that book you're reading and already thinking about what to read next? Nancy Pearl can help. Here she is with KUOW's Marcy Silman.
Nancy, is the dog days of summer wind down. We're still thinking about fiction, I think.
Well, I think sometimes when it's so beautiful out and you just want to get up and be outside, and we've had some great weather this summer, it's hard for me to think about concentrating deeply on an important book of nonfiction, although this fall we'll have lots of good ones. So the book I brought in is a novel by Jean Thompson. And Jean Thompson, for an earlier book, was one of the finalists for the National Book Award.
Oh.
But I had never read her. So I picked up this book for no particular reason and started reading it and just fell in love with the book.
It's called She Poured Out Her Heart. Is that what happens in the book?
Well, it happens on both sides of a relationship, because this is about friendship and the issues of a long-term friendship. Two very different young women meet in college, and one is kind of a free spirit and one is the kind of person who does everything that's expected of her. And rather unexpectedly, and to both their surprises, they become very good friends. And the novel follows them for the next 20 years.
Wow, that's an interesting concept for a book, especially for those of us who've had friendships that have endured for at least 20 years.
Yes, and one of the things I think that makes it work so well is that Jean Thompson has written this book from the point of view of both girls. So they take turns moving the story forward. Huh. So you really get a very full, intimate picture of each of these girls, because they're seen through the eyes of the other person as well as through their own eyes.
I also love the idea that it's a book about friendship rather than love relationship. Nothing against love relationships. Those are really great. But we read so many books. I'm not meaning the romance genre, but romances.
Right.
We're always looking for love or losing love or grieving about love or something. And sometimes long-term friendships can be just as meaningful.
Just as meaningful and just as difficult. Just as difficult to sustain, I would argue. And the relationship between Bonnie and Jane is exactly that relationship. And, you know, their differences. I mean, one of the things she says in here that that I was taken by is I one of them says to the other, you know, the reason that we like each other so much is that neither one of us wants to be the other person. And, you know, when you think about that in terms of your own friends, I think that puts a certain perspective on them. Now, to me, the ending was a little bit unsatisfactory. And I think that many readers felt that the ending, because it wasn't resolved, so you don't know what happens to these characters after the events of the book, that doesn't bother me so much. I think the reason I felt it was unfinished was that I wanted more. It's not a little book. I mean, it's not a huge book, but it's not any 170-page novel.
It's not insignificant. Nancy's riffling through the pages.
Through the pages. So it's 415 pages.
Yeah, that's a
big
chunk.
Book.
Yeah.
Right. But I still wanted more. I wanted more of these two women.
So the author is Jean Thompson, a finalist for a National Book Award. Are you going to go back and read that book?
I think so.
Well, this book is called She Poured Out Her Heart, and maybe you all would like the ending better than Nancy
and
did.
I would love to hear if you did.
Nancy Pearl, thank you.
Thank you, Marcy.
Nancy Pearl speaking with Marcy Silman about the novel She Poured Out Her Heart by Jean Thompson. You can see all of Nancy's book picks at KUOW.org. Our next guests have learned some lessons from working on the technology side of the adult entertainment industry, mainly the importance of privacy. Jen McEwen and Jesse Adams are the developers of a new security app for browsing the internet. Tenta is the name of the app. It would make it impossible for anybody to know what you look up on your phone. The two have run an adult app store for the past decade, and during that time, customers have asked them to provide features to give them more privacy on their phones.
Things like a VPN, encrypted media players, and we realize that a lot of these services that they're looking for extend well beyond an adult app store. This is something that can apply very well to their browsing activity online.
We've been thinking about doing something mainstream as well. That's part of it as well. You know, we do
mainstream it, meaning main, not porn.
Mainstream, yeah, except adult entertainment.
Adult entertainment.
Working on adult apps and just in the mobile world, there's so much just constant censorship and taboo around this world. There's so much that blocks you. You have a lot more restrictions than any other company out there. And so we thought, you know, we're building up all these skills around in mobile technology. What could we do that could be more mainstream and we can drop the weight that we've had working on adult entertainment and apply the skills we've learned into mainstream?
So with this browser, Tenta, every customer has their own PIN number.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Yep. And that PIN code is not stored on any of our servers, so only you have access to your Tenta browser. So even if you, I don't know, forgot your PIN, we couldn't recover any of that data for you. So it's completely secure to just you that we can't even break into your account and, you know, and snoop on you.
Why doesn't everybody have a completely private browser like this?
I think the issue is that you have all the huge browsers out there, and they take a fundamentally different approach. Their whole business model is your data. So they can never really go all in on keep protecting your data. They actually
is there
do,
a privacy setting on these?
There is. There's a
browsers?
Thing called incognito mode.
Yeah.
But they have identity crisis. So really they work best and they're designed from the ground up for years with your data in mind and needs your data to work great. So they've added tools. They support, you know, extensions and plugins in incognito mode. But even incognito mode, which a lot of people use, is very misleading. All it does is erase your web history when you close the browser, but it doesn't prevent ISPs, hackers, trackers to still see and snoop on your traffic, what websites you're going to. Ad trackers can still continually track you across sites and then use that against you. We're not completely against ads, but as we all know, there are a lot of companies who take it too far. So the mainstream browsers, they need your data. And so if you want to go private, they just make that so inconvenient to do so. You have to learn a lot more about what your data is doing. You have to install extensions and plugins and a variety of VPN services and proxies that most people just don't have the time, or maybe it's a little bit, you know, just it's too complicated for most people to even think about doing. They'd rather just open the browser and it goes online and it works. Right?
And what is this for besides adult entertainment?
Of course, it works well for adult entertainment. You want to keep what you're watching away from, you know, your kids, or just keep it private to yourself. But let's say you have a medical condition that you're not ready to share with anybody else or your family, and you want to research about that medical condition. And even to take it more seriously, if you're living in a part of the world where just exploring certain ideas will get you jailed or worse, something like this would be very valuable to them, because then they can still access information that higher powers or their governments might be trying to censor them from without worrying about somebody snooping in on them and watching what they're trying to access or what they're trying to learn.
The flip side of that, as you know, is that when we think fully encrypted, we have come to think about protecting terrorists, right? We had the San Bernardino attack and the battle with Apple and the FBI over the government wanted to get in on that. So would a browser as private as Tenta be enabling criminals and terrorists?
So this is a common fear, I think, that comes with building any new tool. I think obviously, as any entrepreneur, you build something great, the last thing you want is someone to misuse it. But I think that you shouldn't let that fear paralyze you from innovating. You know, knives, for example, they're great. You need them in the kitchen. You can cook food with them. But people can also use it to hurt someone. Our belief is that privacy is non-negotiable, and it's more important to protect the rights of the individual than out of fear of someone trying to do something bad out of the system. I think it's more important to protect the person than the potential fear that someone might do something wrong.
One of you told GeekWire, without privacy, we don't have freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you say that?
Well, privacy is, you know, the freedom of thought. If you don't have the freedom to have private thought or to explore ideas on your own, then how free are you really? We live in a relatively free society, but there's different parts of the world where even just exploring, I don't know, different sexual orientation could get you killed. And how free are you if you can't even just do a quick search on, you know, what is it like to be, you know, bisexual or gay? If you can't even think about that, then you are not free at all. You don't have the privacy to even think about that in your head. If you're getting thought policed, then you're not free at all.
Do you ever stay up worrying, though, about what somebody can do? You know, child abuse, who knows what, you know, behind walls that you would create?
You know, it does bother us, but it's a problem that I think the biggest fear is that there is so much threat out there. There's so many people breaching personal data. I mean, every day you're seeing banks are getting hacked. You're seeing huge corporations getting hacked. Even the NSA is getting hacked. We would argue that these huge breaches of data, where thousands of credit cards are just being sold to the highest bidder, that's more scary, because if you're a company that is holding someone's very vital information and you have a backdoor, then someone's going to find that backdoor and they're going to exploit it and they're going to take your data and they're going to sell it to someone. And so it's more important that the good guys have the best tools they can to protect you and your data.
Most of us do open ourselves up to risk, I guess. We use social media. We bank online. We let our kids play games on our phones. Is there something we're not getting about the importance of privacy?
If you just have somebody's email address, there's a lot of information you can find out about them, because we've been using the internet for decades, not really thinking about every little step that we take is there forever. So now I think we're starting to see that more and more people are becoming aware of how big their shadow is. And I think it's a good conversation to have, and it's good that people are starting to think about this more. And the more information you have about your impact online, the better decisions you can make on what information you choose to share on certain networks or what networks you even choose to join. You know, you see a lot of people leaving, you know, networks like Facebook because they're becoming more aware of the kind of information that Facebook tracks or takes from you.
Yeah. And there's also an educational part of this. You know, everyone knows that if you're on a public Wi-Fi at Starbucks, that can be a little more risky. But then you ask, okay, but what should you do about that? And there might be a lot of different answers on exactly what can you do if you want to check your bank account while you're at Starbucks, for example. And so because of the fact that that answer might be kind of complicated, or there might be so many answers to that question, makes it less approachable. And so it's more daunting. And there's so many – the technology is moving so fast that I think a lot of people, even if they understand it, they just don't have time to do it. And so that's the issue with privacy and security tools today, is that they're – a lot of times they make life a little more inconvenient, so people just forget it altogether.
Jesse Adams and Jen McEwen are the creators of Tenta. It's a secure browsing app for your phone. Thanks for joining us today on The Record on KUOW. I'm Kim Malcolm. Bill Radke is back tomorrow. News headlines are next.